Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll get a first-hand and fresh look into 9/11, the war on terror, and Al-Qaeda. We are joined by Ali Soufan, the author of a new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. Ali Soufan is a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. We'll explore in depth the issues of torture, strategy, and political cover-up with this important insider who will fill in some holes in the insufficient public knowledge available in regard to these momentous events that have shaped the last decade and continue to dominate our lives. Then we'll be joined by Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He has just met with top officials of the IMF, who are concerned that the global economy is in dangerous territory as a European debt crisis threatens to drag us into a deeper recession or even a depression. We'll find out what measures might be taken to reverse the drift and calm the markets. Joining us now is Ali Soufan, who is a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. He has been profiled in The New Yorker and has been featured in books, newspapers, articles, and documentaries across the globe. He is the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and The War Against Al-Qaeda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Soufan.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
And the story begins, of course, in 1979, at least in terms of Al-Qaeda. That was a very key year, given the peace deal between Israel and Egypt, which incensed the Islamist, the number number two guy being Ayman al-Zawahiri and Khattab, and where the inspiration for Al-Qaeda began in Egypt. Then you had, of course, the fall of the Shah, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. But a very important incident that you mention in your book, Ali Soufan, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, was the incident at the holiest shrine of Islam in Mecca. Tell us why that was so significant, the taking of the mosque.
Well, there was always a tension in Saudi Arabia between the government and between the extremist elements of the Wahhabi sect of Islam. And the Wahhabi radicals were actually essential part of the King Abdulaziz army, who established the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and unified Hejaz and Najd and created the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, after all, became kind of like trying to introduce the modern things to the kingdom, and that created a lot of problems between the more traditional elements. Eventually, this clash took a place in November of 1979 when radical Wahhabis took hostage the mosque in Mecca, which is the holiest shrine of Islam. And the Saudis then realized that they have a big problem on their hand with extremists and with the radical elements that wanted to topple the regime of the House of Saud. December of 1979 came as a gift from heaven to the Saudis, where they basically convinced a lot of these radicals that instead of fighting the Islamic King of Saudi Arabia, why don't you go to Afghanistan and fight Soviets? And they became one of the biggest sponsors of the Mujahideen and of recruiting many of the radicals in Saudi Arabia to go to Afghanistan. And bin Laden was a product of this program to get rid of the problem and export it somewhere else. And how a lot of these events that took place prior to 9/11 resulted in the unfortunate and tragic attack that took place on Tuesday, September 11, 2001, and resulted in the death of 2,977 people.
And, of course, on the following day, September the 12th, you were handed the secret file that you'd been asking for months. And had you gotten that file, you believe that with the information in that file, you could have prevented 9/11. But in many ways, of course, a lot of people, and I've spoken a number of times to Mike Scheuer about it, and recently with Glenn Carl and others who have been involved in this, in what's been called the War on Terror. If you go back to Sudan, apparently he was certainly on the U.S.'s radar then, Bin Laden. I understand that, you
know, absolutely.
And Billy War, the guy that ran the CIA's paramilitary, he apparently wanted to take care of Bin Laden and throw his body over the wall of the Iranian embassy there. So what prevented the earliest, when he was really much more vulnerable, if you will, in Sudan, what prevented the U.S. from nabbing him then?
We didn't have people paying attention to Bin Laden at a strategic level in Washington. This is a threat, yes, but, we don't see how the threat is impacting us. This is basically what people in Washington were thinking. You know, the guy, when he was in Sudan, still allegedly never attacked the U.S., and you don't want to do preventive attack against him. People didn't want it, you know how it is in Washington. People have a lot of problems to deal with, and if you come with them with a problem that didn't happen yet and say, hey, this is going to happen, let's disrupt it, you know, nobody's going to listen to you. But definitely, you know, at that point, the Saudis wanted to deal with that problem because for them, he's a little bit scary. They don't want what happened in November of 1979 to keep repeating itself. But also at the same time, Bin Laden in Afghanistan, he established again, or he reestablished again, the Golden Chain, which is the money flow that sustained the Mujahideen in Afghanistan during the Soviet jihad. And many of these contacts he still have the popularity. And there's a lot of support that he have in the Arabian Peninsula, and especially in Saudi Arabia, from sheikhs and from religious scholars and from, very wealthy people who basically believe in his ideas and believe in what he's trying to do. And, they funded his operation for a long period of time, and some continue to fund Al-Qaeda.
Well, the first time that the U.S. went after him was when President Clinton fired the cruise missiles at these training camps after
sure.
the bombing of
yeah.
the embassies. And, of course, that was at a time when Clinton was beset by problems to do with Monica Lewinsky, and he was accused of distracting the public with this. But Bin Laden himself has thanked the Pakistanis for tipping him off, didn't it, that the cruise missiles were coming?
Well, there was a lot of information at the time that he was, he had been tipped off. You're correct. And I think at the time, unfortunately, that became a political issue and a partisan issue. So now if you talk about the threat of Bin Laden, some people were telling you, it's wagging the dog, this is because of Monica Lewinsky. Unfortunately, it wasn't because of Monica Lewinsky. There was a threat, and two of our embassies were blown up in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi. So this is, unfortunately, how sometimes domestic politics stand in the way of carrying out what's best for the national security of the United States.
So let's move forward a little bit and not keep beating the dead horse about how many times we could have got him. But clearly that is
many,
what,
many times.
that's what haunts you. And just in terms of your story, in the context of what we're talking about, when did you get teamed up with John O'Neill, who was this fascinating guy that was the number one FBI agent in terms of his understanding of Al-Qaeda? He was kind of a Cassandra who unfortunately wasn't listened to. And, of course, tragically and ironically, he took a job after he quit the FBI to head up security at the World Trade Center and died on 9/11.
John was a phenomenal figure. And early on, when I was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York, I met John. And I was very intimidated the first time I met him. I mean, he's a character bigger than life. He's known as a legend in the FBI. He was the special agent in charge of the National Security Division. And I was at the time a new agent, a rookie. who had some ideas about terrorism, about, Islamic extremism, about bin Laden. And I was so lucky that John actually gave me the opportunity and took me under his wing. And I learned tremendously from him. Unfortunately, as you said, the person who was leading the hunt on Osama bin Laden, the person who was trying to wake everyone up in Washington and say, listen, this person is for real, and he is going to attack, the big one is coming, nobody would listen to, died on the day of September 11 in the World Trade Center.
But Ali Soufan, what must have surely burned you and burned John O'Neill was at the time of the Cole bombing, the Bush administration refused to say that al-Qaeda was behind the Cole bombing. And
absolutely. I mean, we had, first of all, as you know, the bombing happened on October of 2000, on October 12 of 2000. And then after that, we had everybody in Washington was busy with the election. And then we had a problem between, the whole thing between Bush versus Gore and, the fiasco that took place at that time. And after that, it was very clear that, unfortunately, the administration at the time did not want, the call to be involved in the USS, the bin Laden, sorry, did not want bin Laden to be involved in the call attack. And we saw that firsthand. And then later on, even in the 9/11 commission, people from the administration called the cold case stale, and that's why they didn't want to respond to the attack on the USS Cole.
But what is the logic behind President Bush not wanting to risk political capital by telling the American people that what was obvious, which was that bin Laden was a serial killer, he struck at the embassies, and now he struck at the USS Cole? Because this leads directly to questions about the Bush administration's their attitude to all the information that was passed on to them by the Clinton people. Many people say that the Bush people were governed by ABC, anything but Clinton, that they just simply wouldn't.
I think you hit it. You had a bullseye here. I mean, first of all, anything that's coming from the Clinton administration was not considered as legitimate. Remember, and this is also part of the 9/11 Commission, so we can talk about it now, that the Attorney General at the time did not believe that there is a threat called terrorism, and they cut the terrorism budget of the FBI. So they didn't want it to deal with the whole issue of terrorism. After all, terrorism is wag the dog of Clinton because he want to cover his thing with Monica Lewinsky, as you correctly mentioned before. So that's basically one of the things that was going on at the time. We were not able to convince people of the threat of terrorism and the threat of bin Laden and that how serious that is. Another thing that we heard of, and I talk about in the book, is basically, the president was considered a weak president. The country was not unified behind him. And if we announced that bin Laden was behind the call, then he has to respond. And by responding, he has to go to Afghanistan. He do have to do some military actions. And at the time, they thought that, since the country is not unified behind him, that can create a lot of problems. So that's one of the reasons that they did not want it to respond to the call.
So what was in that file that made you realize, my God, if I had this information, we could have acted on it?
Right. I think it was, information that we've been asking for since November of 2000. During the call investigation, one of the people, one of al-Qaeda terrorists involved in the call, told us about a meeting that took place in Southeast Asia. And we requested information from everyone in the government if anyone knows anything about that specific meeting. And then we continued to basically follow leads on our own as part of the call investigation, and we got more and more information regarding the meeting. We've been told that there's nothing going on. Nobody is aware of anything's going on about that specific meeting. on September 12th, we were told that, two people who were involved in that meeting were on Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon. And we were giving surveillance photos that was taken in January of 2000, around the millennium, of people who were involved in that alleged meeting in Southeast Asia that we've been asking about for month and month. If we were giving that information, I believe September 11 could have been a different day. And it's not only me who said that. I mean, if you look at the commission, the 9/11 commission report, one of the very first findings they have is if the CIA had passed the information regarding the Malaysia meeting to the FBI team investigating the USS Cole, they mentioned the Cole by name. They mentioned our team by name. A lot of things could have happened early on to disrupt the plot of 9/11. Also, the CIA's own inspector general regarding 9/11, which, their executive summary has been also declassified. It basically came to the same findings and, came to the same conclusion by saying that they did not pass the information on a timely basis to the FBI, nor to the State Department, nor to the Immigration and Naturalization Services, nor bothered to put these people on a no-fly list. So this is what I did in the book is I presented the facts. I presented the facts as they happened. So people, when they read it, they know why the 9/11 Commission reached to that conclusion. They know why the CIA IG reached to that conclusion. I put faces to that story and how 9/11 could have been, possibly stopped.
Again, I'm speaking with Ali Soufran, who's a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda. He is the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Ali Soufran.
Tall buildings shake, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs, tuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Don't cry.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm speaking with Ali Soufran, who is a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda. He's the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. So, Ali Soufran, what have you come to conclude about why the information about the two hijackers down in San Diego was withheld, and the latest stuff that's coming out now that Senator Graham is asking for inquiries into, that there were some Saudis down there that were helping the hijackers down in Florida as well. There's two possibilities: either these people were working for Al Qaeda in terms of the Saudis, or that the Saudis were trying to turn these people, or that the CIA was trying to turn these people.
I think this 9/11 is a very important period of our history. And what I decided to do when I took that mission of writing the book is to stick to the fact and to present the fact of what I know happened in that period of time. I mean, there's a lot of analysis from people who are way higher than me, like Mr. Clark, Senator Graham, those people had a lot more access to information than me, and they are coming to conclusions. I decided not to come to my personal conclusions. I have my personal conclusions. I have my personal ideas of what possibly happened. But I don't know. I will be saying just assumptions.
Sure.
What I wanted to do, because this is part of history, I wanted to do it like an FBI agent will do it. You know, an FBI agent, we were taught, you only present the facts. Don't put your own assumptions in the middle of the facts.
Right.
And this is such an important period of our history. 9/11 changed the world, my friend. Not only the United States, changed the world. And I think I don't want to make a political stand, a partisan stand. I don't want to come to assumptions that maybe I'm wrong and right. mix it to the facts of what happened. So what I decided to do in this is just tell the American people and tell the world, these are the facts.
Right.
You know, these things went through government approval process. It have been verified. And
sure.
readers can make up their minds regarding the facts and can get to conclusions. And hopefully somebody else tomorrow will write a book similar to mine, putting their facts as they saw it. And then we can start connecting the dots and see exactly what happened. But until today, 10 years after the 9/11 Commission, after the CIAIG, I personally do not believe we have an answer yet.
Sure.
Well, you
can understand why I'm asking, and
no,
your,
absolutely.
And your book is full
I agree
of
with you.
Book is full of redactions. Again, the book, The Black Banner, is the inside story of 9/11 and the war against Al Qaeda by Ali Soufan. But specifically in terms of your personal knowledge, just sticking with what you just said, then, where you're presenting what you know personally. In 2010, you say there was a missed opportunity to get bin Laden because the official in charge of Guantanamo refused to support a deal made between you and a key detainee. This is despite the endorsement of CIA and FBI officials. What in God's name happened there?
Well, you know, at the time we're looking for Osama bin Laden, right? And this is actually, it happened, I think, in 2002 or 2003, around that time period. We're looking for Osama bin Laden. We have no leads. And then we get a guy in Guantanamo who is very close to Osama bin Laden. He is related to bin Laden's Yemeni wife. We knew that bin Laden's Yemeni wife at the time is with bin Laden. We thought, you know, if he want to make a phone call to check on his wife, let's follow up what happens after that. You know, who the family of the wife is going to call, you know what I mean? And how it's, you know, and maybe that will lead us to where where bin Laden is. That was a lead. I mean, we didn't know 100% it's going to lead us. We didn't even know 50% if it's going to lead us. But there's no other leads at the time towards Osama bin Laden. And now, as we know now, after we killed bin Laden finally, 10 years after, that the Yemeni wife was with bin Laden. So was there a possibility that that can lead us to bin Laden, that can lead us to someone who can lead us to bin Laden? That possibility will still be there. Unfortunately, at the time, even when we lacked any evidence any specific actionable intelligence that might lead us to anyone who might lead us to bin Laden, they decided to drop the ball and not follow the lead.
But what you say in your book is, though, that in 2002, an important al-Qaeda terrorist held in Guantanamo was released without even notifying his interrogators. What happened there?
Well, this person is really high up in the group, even to the point that many members of al-Qaeda think that he's a member of the Shura Council at the time. He was very close with Osama bin Laden. He has been with Osama bin Laden since Afghanistan, since the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And he went with him to Sudan, and then he went back with him, flew back with him to Afghanistan when bin Laden left Sudan back to Afghanistan. After the 1998 embassy bombings, bin Laden appointed him to be the head of his, kind of equivalent of our secret service. It's called the Guards, the security detachment. He was the head of that unit under bin Laden, very close to him. This guy was the highest ranking Qaeda guy we had in our custody. And overnight, he was taken away. We had no idea where he was taken. He just disappeared. And later on, I was reading a newspaper, an Arabic newspaper, Al-Hayati newspaper, actually, an Arabic paper published in London. And in it, I read that a judge in Morocco released him. And they couldn't find enough evidence to prosecute him. And then I knew that basically he was rendered to a different country, and that country just simply released him.
I guess you never were able to find out on whose order was this person released and why. I mean, that's the part that's extraordinary, given that we held people that we shouldn't have been holding, and in by holding them we radicalized them, but somebody that was actually what they refer to as a high-value target was let go is kind of incomprehensible. I mean, it reminds me of what Glenn Carl was saying recently, the CIA interrogator, that he was interrogating somebody that he knew was innocent. And yet the more he protested to the Bush administration, and specifically it was coming from Cheney, the more they insisted on more enhanced interrogation methods.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that resulted to false information anyway. And you're right. I mean, there is a guy that we knew for sure 100%. He is high-level Qaeda operative, and he leaves the island. And people that we knew, they are nothing, they stayed in the island. That's something that I don't have an answer for, but I think it's a very, very good question.
So Ali Safon, in terms of some of the sort of touchstones in our concern about terrorism and those that would attack us, we've had a series of attempts, the latest being the Times Square. Fellow referred sometimes as the jockstrap bomber. Then you had the guy with the shoes. And then, of course, prior to that, there was Padilla, who they made a big fuss about. But you're saying that the real story about Padilla is wasn't told, and that the Attorney General totally misrepresented him, and you were told not to contradict the information because the President Bush was making a speech.
Yeah, this is in 06. You know, we've been told the whole thing about the contradiction. We've been told in 06 that Padilla, we identified him as a dirty bomber. And again, this is allegation. You know, Padilla doesn't know anything about a dirty bomb. I mean, you know, he has the intent, but definitely he doesn't have the capability in any way, shape, or form, nor the knowledge on how to do it. But he was a bad guy, and he was a member of the terrorist group, and he was being sent back home to conduct terrorist attacks. So what the president said in 06, and after that it has been repeated again and again, that enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding led us to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11. It also led us to identify Jose Padilla as a dirty bomber, plus a few other terrorist plots that were disrupted allegedly because waterboarding and because Abu Zubaydah provided that information after he was waterboarded. Well, this is not true. And the facts are basically the facts very opposite. Actually, these kind of techniques prove that Abu Zubaydah was talking before waterboarding, because waterboarding did not start until August of 2002. August of 2002. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was identified as the mastermind of 9/11 in April of 2002. Padilla was identified, according to the court documents today, in April of 2002. So how can a person identified in April of 2002, arrested in May of 2002, how come that happened as a result of waterboarding, a technique that did not start until August of 2002? It doesn't make sense. So basically what happened after the OLC memos has been released and after this false narrative was being, you know, promoted by members of the former administration.
Sure. OLC, for the benefit of the audience, is the Office of Legal Counsel. That's the John Yoo memo, right?
Yeah, it's Bradbury, Yoo, right. And Steve, and Judge Bybee, and so forth.
Sure,
all these memos, right. A combination of few of them together.
Sorry to interrupt you, but go ahead.
Yeah. So basically, and what I testified about in the Senate, I testified that this information is not accurate. We did not know about Padilla. We did not know about KSM because of waterboarding. Actually, we knew about the month before waterboarding was even applied. And my statement to the Senate on Abu Zubaydah and on the alleged efficacy of these techniques is the only statement and remain until today to be the only statement under oath. And it's actually the fact, because I was there when we knew about KSM. I was there when we knew about Padilla. I was there when we knew about the alleged apartment complex threat that we were told that resulted of waterboarding. I was there when we were told about the Brooklyn Bridge. I was there when we were told about all these things, and we were not using waterboarding whatsoever.
So why do you think that it's been so difficult for the American people to understand how what a terrible misstep, if that's putting it mildly, torture has been, both in terms of its effectiveness, but also the enormous damage it's done to the reputation of the United States. And surely it has an impact in terms of foreign policy, because look at the Assad clan in Syria murdering their own people. All they have to do, or Mugabe in Zimbabwe, or Gaddafi, the whole pantheon of these bad guys out there.
Sure. Well, I think the very first thing, the question is, enhanced interrogation techniques, the whole 12 steps of them, as appalling as they are to people in the West, to people in the United States, they are nothing compared to what happens in Syrian jails or Egyptian jails or jails around the Middle East. This is like the welcoming party before the even interrogation starts. And this is one of the problems that I have with their efficacy, because basically, you're talking about, going down on a route where you're going to hit a glass ceiling. The glass ceiling is, the last step, which is waterboarding. And the person is going to keep repeating it again and again and again because there is no other step. And then the detainee will call your bluff, and then the detainee becomes in control, not you in control. So this is one of the issue that with the problem. The problem with why people did not understand it is people lived in fear for a long period of time, as you know, and people fear the unknown, and people were told a narrative that hasn't been challenged for a long period of time. It hasn't been challenged because the challenge was classified, and until now, even though a lot of these things has been in public domain, has been declassified by government documents, you see some of the portions of my book that has been redacted to protect that false narrative out there, to protect the false narrative that if enhanced interrogation techniques worked. I think the challenge of these techniques start to happen. And you have people like Glenn Call, you have people like myself, you have other people who are going out and saying, look, you know what, this is not what happened. Let us tell you what happened. Let us tell you how this program was very ineffective. And I think people, when they are fearful and they were told that, you dunk somebody a couple of times in the water and then they're going to talk, they say, well, we're fine with it, if it keeps us safe. We were sold that fake concept of ticking bomb, which basically doesn't exist in real world. And even if it exists, enhanced interrogation techniques, as were set up by the Office of Legal Counsel, is not the answer of the ticking bomb theory. Waterboarding comes towards the end of these techniques. And, from the beginning to the end, to reach waterboarding, sleep deprivation alone is more than a week. So in a more than a week, you don't have a ticking bomb theory now. The building already blew up, So these techniques are not effective, and it's not only me who's saying that. I gave you all the evidence where, everything that you've been told was resulted from enhanced interrogation techniques. I'm telling you, based on firsthand experience, I was there, I witnessed it, and it was not because of waterboarding. But also from the CIA IG. Look at the CIA IG report. The CIA IG evaluated the CIA program. And when it came to the enhanced interrogation technique portion of that program, it said that, you know, it's very hard to evaluate, and even evaluating it is not without any concerns. And the CIA talks about, the CIA Inspector General talks about the same arguments that you're making. The short-term effect and the long-term effect, strategic effect on the United States and on the reputation of the CIA if they participated in that program. And also, the CIAIG, reviewed all the alleged plots that were disrupted because of VIT. And they came to a conclusion, and this is in the CIA Inspector General report, that after reviewing all these plots, they could not verify that any of these plots, these alleged plots that were disrupted because of waterboarding and enhanced interrogation techniques, were imminent. So there is the CIA itself saying no imminent attack can be verified, or they cannot verify any imminent attack, that was disrupted or stopped because of enhanced interrogation techniques. So I think we need to push back on the efficacy issue, because it is because of their effectiveness. Personally, I'm against them. And I know with asymmetrical warfare, with the nature of the threat of Al-Qaeda, with, the whole issue about appearing as hypocrites around the world, that will have not only short-term harms, but long-term negative implication on the United States' reputation and strategy. But why even evaluating all these things if the techniques themselves never saved lives in the first place? So I think more and more now we're hoping that people will come out like Glenn Carr, like other, and discuss these kind of things. More people, hopefully, after my book, they can read the CIA Inspector General, they can read the Department of Justice Inspector General, they can read the Office of Professional Responsibility on the Office of the Legal Counsel. And all the truth is hidden in plain sight. You know, and don't follow, you know, what politicians are trying to say, what bureaucrats who are invested in the program are trying to say, because these guys are not telling the facts and not telling the truth. The truth speaks of itself.
Well, Ali Safwan, again, the author of the Black Banners, the Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, since you're now chief executive officer of the Safwan Group and you're doing risk analysis and consulting in the Middle East in particular, since you're an Arabic speaker, obviously. Let's finish up with a perspective on what you're currently doing in terms of what you just said, you know, the negative effects of the Bush-Cheney era's use of torture in terms of our reputation in that part of the world. The ground is shifting there dramatically with the Arab Spring. It's had paradoxically, it would seem that now our traditional foreign policy of realpolitik, where we act according to our so-called interests and not necessarily according to our ideals, no longer serves us. In fact, it's our ideals that are our best weapon, surely, in terms of winning the support of the people who are braving the streets. I mean, you have to credit these young people in Syria in particular facing lethal military weaponry at the hands of a ruthless dictatorship.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw the same thing with millions of people going to Tahrir Square and talking about freedoms and about free elections and about freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. These are all American ideals. We saw the same thing in Tunisia. We see the same thing going on in Syria, as you mentioned, with people fighting against a very ruthless, security apparatus by the Assad regime. So, I mean, you're right. Our ideals are phenomenal ideals, and everybody around the world wants freedom. Everybody wants, these basic rights, and people are fighting for it around the Arab world. And that needs to be part of our strategy in defeating Al-Qaeda. Tactically, we have been doing a good job in beating them, in kind of weakening their structure. But strategically, we didn't even touch on that. We didn't even touch about the ideology, about the narrative that makes this group the way it is, the counterculture that created for themselves within the Muslim world and within the Arab culture. And I think what you mentioned is totally correct. We need to develop a strategic counter-narrative approach in dealing with these issues. And our strategy and our laws and our values need to be in sync. And if they were not in sync, and if they are not in sync, unfortunately, that's going to fire back on us. I mean, Sun Tzu said a long time ago, if you know your enemy and know yourself, you will win 100 times in 100 battles. Unfortunately, we didn't take the time to study the nature of our enemy. And in the last 10 years, I hate to say that we forget about who we are as people. And that's why 400 Qaeda operatives on the eve of 9/11 lasted in a war longer than World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Ali Soufan.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Soufan. He's a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. He's the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not we are drifting into a recession or a global depression.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?